Welcome to room 4216. I'm so glad you've come.
Interesting. Let's get in here. Oh, wow. Now, I didn't expect that.
Hi, Cecilia.
Wow.
You reading something?
Oh, hello, Pastor Dave. I'm reading the Book of Numbers.
Numbers?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's a book just full of numbers.
Oh, come
People
on.
Being counted.
You haven't read the Book of Numbers in your time, oh wise pastor?
I don't know.
No, there's some good stuff in here. I mean, we're talking snakes, Miriam getting leprosy. Oh, not to mention the talking donkey. Now that's interesting.
Let's go ahead and get into the book and let's see what these interesting things are. Talking donkey. That was in Shrek, I think.
Why is it called the Book of Numbers? Well, the name comes from the census that was taken both in chapter 1 and in chapter 26. They were counting the number of Israelite men that were able to serve in the army.
Which is interesting because it didn't count the women and children. Need to mention that. Now, the word numbers, which we have, actually comes from the Greek translation, which is called the Septuagint, the 70. Lore has it that 70 priests were put together and they translated the Bible from the Hebrew to the Greek. And amazingly, when they looked at the manuscripts, they were all the same.
Wow.
So that was the Greek consensus. Whether it was that or not, it was a very good, thorough translation from the Hebrew to the Greek. And it happens to be the first word was numbers in the Greek.
Well, in Hebrew, the book is named totally different. It's the translation means in the desert.
Yeah, showed the life in the desert of the people.
Both the physical and the spiritual.
Very dry, parched, miserable. And we'll see that quite often. You would think after being freed from slavery in Egypt, the people would show faith, gratitude, and obedience.
Yeah, instead, they showed unbelief, ungratitude, and disobedience.
And yet, despite the people's disobedience, God was determined to bless them and bring them to the promised land.
You know, it wasn't because of them. It was because of God's character. We can see this in many stories in Numbers, particularly the story of Balaam.
And mentioning stories, Balaam is one of the stories that comes out very big. There's also, though, the story of the bronze snake.
There was the rock that spit out water for the people's thirst.
And there was also God giving food for them each and every day.
There was the pillar of cloud by day. Oof. And the pillar of fire at night.
There were six cities of refuge that people could run to.
And Korah's revolt. Just to name a few.
Yeah. The Book of Numbers has a simple outline of three major parts. Part one is being in the desert of Sinai. The second is being in Kadesh. It's a country next to there. And then the third is the plains of Moab. And if we see through all these different parts, these stories coming about. Oh, and I should say the last four chapters or so are just kind of tossed in there to round out the book. So let's start to dig into the Book of Numbers. Let's start right away with verse 1, Cecilia.
The Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. He said, "Take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families."
By their clans and families. So it's 1 year later. We've had the book of Exodus, where they traveled around in Mount Sinai area a little bit, got the Ten Commandments, and then the The Levites were set apart in order to do sacrifices, and now God is trying to organize them into more of a military type style of order by the clans. Why don't you start with that anyway?
We'll give an example of how the census was taken. From the descendants of Reuben, the firstborn son of Israel, or Jacob, all the men 20 years old or more who were able to serve in the army were listed by name, one by one, according to the records of the clans and families. The number from the tribe of Reuben was 46,500.
46,500 men over 20 ready to serve in war. That was the census for them. That doesn't include the women or the children under 20.
No.
That's a huge amount of people. What we're going to find, if we read them all, just as you read the clans and the tribes, the families, it's going to do this with each one. First was Reuben, and then comes Simeon, and then all of them, all the tribes. And the total number?
The total number, according to verse 46, is 603,550.
Wow. That's a pretty good-sized army. And that's what God is trying to help organize, because they were going to have to fight some battles. But also, I want to note right away, it did not count those from the tribe of Levi.
That was the tribe of Moses and Aaron.
Yes, yes. And in the last couple verses of this chapter, 48 through the end, 51 or so, it talks about the Levites. And we're going to find God setting the Levites apart for something special in the following chapters. Do you remember having fire drills in the school, Cecilia?
Boy, do I ever.
What do you remember after that first jolt of an alarm? After the alarm.
I was going to say, I remember being in science class and the thing sounding so loud. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. It just puts you out of your skin almost. But then
I remember that we were always told, follow the teacher and go outside and follow the teacher to a certain spot.
Ever notice? I noticed when I was in school that each teacher knew where to go. Whether it was in middle school, the science teacher, they go here or there. And in grade school, the third graders go on that sidewalk. The fourth graders go out that door on that sidewalk. It's just to bring order, to get everyone out of the building quickly and in good order so that no one's hurt.
Yeah, I guess they did.
Well, that's really what chapter 2 is all about in the book of Numbers. God is telling them how to order themselves and set up camp. And it's interesting because it's all circled around the tent of meeting and the tabernacle. Those are at the very middle. And then several clans are to the east, several to the west, to the north, south. What's interesting is that when you look at that, it makes a cross with the temple right in the middle.
That's it, really?
Left and the right, top, bottom. And isn't that the way we are organized around Jesus and his cross, even as Christians today? Well, let's go on to chapter 3, because that's all chapter 2 does, is tell them where to camp, how to camp around the tent. Chapter 3, would you read verse 1?
This is the account of the family of Aaron and Moses at the time the Lord talked with Moses on the Mount Sinai.
And so you'll find this chapter and following is all about just the Levites, because you remember I said they were separate from all the other tribes of Israel. And we find out why. I think it was verse 12 and following. If you could read that, God will actually tell us why.
I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. When I struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, I set apart for myself every firstborn in Israel, whether man or animal. They are to be mine. I am the Lord.
And so we remember back, and this is only 1 year past, they would all remember this, being in Egypt, And God struck down in that Passover where they had the meal and were ready. And the firstborn of every male in Egypt that didn't have blood on the doorposts was struck down. And that was a promise looking forward then to Jesus, our firstborn, who was struck down. And it's not our doorposts, but our very lives that are covered by the blood of Jesus, setting us apart. Well, God, rather than taking the firstborn of Reuben and Simeon and all those clans, he decided in his wisdom, it would be easier just to separate one whole clan because he needs people to help with the worship. And that's what he's doing here with the Levites, where the worship in the temple. And
he's showing that each one of us have our place, isn't he?
He is.
And I can show you an example. Verse 36. The Merarites were appointed to take care of the frames of the tabernacle, its crossbars, posts, bases, all its equipment, and everything related to their use.
And this is just one clan. There's many clans and many parts to the temple. And you think, well, a whole clan of 60,000 people, because remember, we had the numbers of like Reuben, that who are, they're all in the thousands numbers.
Right.
Well, sometimes people are sick. They have to rotate. When they're moving from day to day, there's probably, they're pooped. And so the next group would have to take over in that clan. So even though there were 60,000 people, well,
that was 60,000 per tribe.
Per tribe. And so 60,000 for Levi meant each clan would only have maybe 1,000 or two. Mm-hmm. And in of that, some would get tired for one day, so the next would take over. So they had to have people rotating in and out. God, in such a special way, prepared his people to be on the move and utilize them. And what's so awesome is, even as you alluded to, Cecilia, that's what God does for us in the New Testament as well. We all also have a part to play. In chapter 4, just as we had in chapter 3, we have the description of the tabernacle and how it is not only taken apart and how it's disassembled, but then how each one of the clans of Levi are assigned to each one of it for its movement.
Its movement, the utensils and all that stuff that went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Gav gave some pretty minute details as to what needed to be done, right?
He sure did.
Now, Moses seems to be a pretty smart guy. God wouldn't have chosen him if he weren't, right?
Yeah.
Why did God do all this? Why didn't he just leave Moses to figure it out?
Micromanage the system.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Well, two thoughts come to mind. One, maybe he's just trying to ease Moses' burden because he's had trouble with the people, and so he's not giving him another detail thing, so he has to think it through. It's giving him the plan. But I think even more than that is because this is God's place of worship, where God is, he is very much involved with it because it's his house. And so he wants to each of us to know that each of us have a specific place and purpose in his service, in his house.
Sometimes I don't feel like I have a place, a part that I'm supposed to play in God's house.
I bet a lot of people feel that way. Ah, but
okay, get my ruler and measurement board. Okay, and now set the marker down. And I gotta get the clamp. And we cut. Good. Okay, what am I looking for here in the toolkit? No, not my hammer. There it is, the tape measure. Yeah. Measure the distance I want. Got it. And done. Put my board into place.
Except the screw and screw. There we go.
Pastor Dave, what does this have to do with anything?
Well, I have many tools, and I'm changing the garage. It's a tiny one-car garage into our kitchen, and I was picking up this tool and that tool to do specific things. And I have lots of tools, but I don't use them all the time for everything.
Oh, okay.
And that's how we are in God's service. We all have a special purpose, but we aren't used all the time for everything.
I still say that many of us don't feel like we're used at all.
Oh, I think you know.
But now that you mention it, well, we have a tiny congregation that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
So for the past weeks and months, I have had the joy of two twin friends, and I've watched them grow up pretty much as between.
Now,
I'm sorry,
Cecilia. I'm going to ask you, what does this have to do with anything?
Well, see, for the past weeks and months, my friend Liz will come to me and say, "Cecilia, would you like to hold James?" Well, would I like to? Well, of course. But I've often thought, Liz is just humoring a poor blind person, a poor old maid who's never going to have kids. But then one day she said to me, "Oh, thank you, Cecilia, for holding James for me. I was so much more able to participate in the worship because I wasn't holding a baby." Oh. Wait a minute. I was needed.
You were needed. And I love that example. Sometimes you don't even know when you're needed.
Yeah,
and that's why we have to do everything as though we are needed all the time. So now we come to chapter 5 of Numbers. Interesting chapter. Mm-hmm. But before we jump into it, first, we got to back up and just lay the groundwork. Chapters 2 and 3, it talked about where the tribes would be in location to the tabernacle, as far as where they would tent every night.
Mm-hmm.
And then in chapter 4, talked about the Levites in specific and how they were to take care of that tabernacle in the movement, that the clans would take different things and move them and be in charge of it. So now we come to chapter 5. The first thing God says in the first couple of verses is, if anyone is found with a skin disease, they should be put out of the camp. It was God's way of saying,
right,
he wants the camp to be holy, not just spiritually, but physically as well. And then he adds to that, just coming right up following, if you commit a sin against another person, really, you're breaking faith with God.
And then we come to a part I don't like again.
Okay.
We come to these every now and again in the Bible, you know.
Uh-huh.
This is verses 11 through 31. So I'm not going to read it. I'm going to summarize it.
Okay.
A husband accuses his wife of adultery.
Mm.
So he takes her and a grain offering to the temple. The priest has the woman stand before the Lord. And he then takes a jar. And he puts some holy water into the jar.
That would be water that's taken from the basin within the temple, because that's holy. Okay.
Uh-huh. And then he takes dust from the floor of the tabernacle, and he mixes it in with the water.
Now, that might sound weird to people, and they might think, ooh, dust in the water. But actually, it was to symbolize that God's part of this. Not only holy water, but he's part of it because God walked on that dust. So the dust is recognizing God's presence.
Then he says to the woman, if you have not committed adultery, may this curse not harm you.
Okay.
But if you have committed adultery, may your hips shrivel up and your stomach expand.
Whoa.
And you get no children.
Oh, that would be a bad curse.
And the woman says, amen, so let it be. Then the priest writes all that stuff that he just said on a scroll.
Okay, the curse.
And he washes it off into the jar with the water and the dust.
Okay.
And then he gives it to the woman and she has to drink it.
Oh. Yeah. So she's ingesting everything she just made a vow to do and say that I am innocent. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Then if she wasn't committing adultery, everything was fine. But if she did, if she did, the bad stuff happened.
The curse would take care, take force.
If there's adultery, then there's two involved. Why doesn't the man get to go through this?
Well, now, just a moment. Just a moment. What word was used here? Because we did read this just so we could summarize it, because it was just way too long to read. Mm-hmm. And what word did it keep using again and again and again?
Well, there are several. Adultery, curse, woman.
Okay, nope, nope, nope. They are, but nope. Jealousy. A jealous husband. It uses it six different times. That's why this is all done. Because if you catch somebody in the act of...
Then they were stoned.
Right. This is not in the act of, but a jealous husband, a suspicious husband, and then this all takes place.
And the offerings weren't called adultery offerings. They were called jealousy offerings.
Right. Right. So should we do this today?
Well, it sounds like the Salem witch trials, to be honest with you.
It's funny you say that. The only thing there, though, with the Salem witch trials, they actually put them underwater. And if they don't drown, then they're not. Well, this doesn't have anything to do with a certain death. This is really more, well, guilt and remorse. Because after all, if you were guilty and you took an oath, what would happen to you if you were guilty, Cecilia?
And I swore that I wasn't. I wouldn't feel too good.
Right. It would eat you up from the inside out, not just mentally. If you carry so much guilt mentally, it will affect you physically. And we've seen and demonstrated that even in modern medicine today. Mm. It will eat you up and destroy you from the inside out.
Not all people, though, right?
Well, if you got the extreme narcissist, no. But they're going to go on sinning and do whatever they want. The average person before the Lord, it will impact. And so this was a visible, clear way of helping people face the reality. They're not just talking to a person, they're talking to God. And that's what the verses earlier talked about. If you sin in any way, you're breaking faith with God. Well, as always happens, Cecilia, our time runs out, and so it is today, so we need to close.
But we are ending on a note of law here.
It does kind of. That's all chapter 5. Tell you what, let's turn the page to chapter 6.
All right.
And in verse 22, God talks about the blessing that Aaron, the high priest, should give. Go ahead, please, and give that.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace.
These are such comforting words, because he knows that these are going to the people that screw up, mess up, have broken relationships. And he still says, be gracious, shine his face, and give you his peace. Not a peace of ending of hostility, but a peace that goes deep into the heart of the relationship between man and woman and God. We'll pick up more on that next time, but until then, please do write us. You can do so at
info,
I-N-F-O,
at not-alone,
N-O-T-A-L-O-N-E,
.net.
I think that's spelled N-E-T.
I think so.
And remember, and we
are not alone.
Do come back again to room 4216.
Credits. Our sincere thanks go to Terry Nord and Robert Vaughn for their interlude music.